I've started the recording. Welcome to the second lecture. Please, at any point, just interrupt me if you want to know something. Nobody is interrupting. Nope. So, in that case, let me start. We talked about a linear regression model on the last lecture. And this linear regression model, what it did is that it got the input describing one training example as a vector of b numbers, right? And then using this input value, it computed the prediction by using this linear regression model, which means it took all the inputs and multiplied each input value by its specific weight. So if there were d values on the input, it had d weights, multiply them together, and it was done. And maybe it also added some constant, right? This constant, we called it bias, and it's actually possible to hide it inside the weights by creating a new so-called feature by new input for each of the training instance, which will be constant, right? So we can look at it, or if we are not really much interested into it, we can imagine that there is a specific x, which is just one for all the training instances, then its corresponding weight is b, and we don't need to write it actually. So this was our model, and what we did, we tried to train it by minimizing an error function between the real target values and the predictions of the model did. And exactly, we computed the square of the distance, and then either sum them to get sum of squares or compute an average to get a mean square error. And the idea was that if we can make this error as small as possible, our model is better and better in describing the training data and explaining or how to say the training data. And we were actually able to do it by computing the derivative, and then after some math, we ended up with an explicit solution which tells us, okay, these optimal weights, which minimize this error function, can be computed by this formula, which contained an inverse of some matrix, and we just hoped that the matrix would have an inversion, so it would be regular. So that's what we did on the last lecture. And then I tried to show you, and you even have to do it in your assignments, that even if the model is called a linear regression, it doesn't need to model functions which are only linear. We talked about, for example, this specific example where the inputs, the training instances, were the points on the x-axis, and we represented each by actually not just the value x, but multiple values. One of them was just constant one, then there was x squared and x cubed. These four values were the representation of this training instance. We could call them features, like four features for each training instance. And then what the linear regression does, well, it can model such polynomials or such functions which looks like w3 times x cubed plus w2 times x squared plus w1x plus w0. So this is actually like any polynomial function of a degree of 3. So even if we have a linear regression, and even if it's linear in functions, it can actually be non-linear with respect to the input values, right? Because we can create non-linear features. And we also talked about an interesting observation that if we add increase the order of the polynomial, like the number of features which we have for the for training, then increasing this actually decreases the training error. Right? So having more and more possibilities, more and more functions, is beneficial, even to the situation where we will hit zero training error if there are enough weights, right? If we really want to find the coefficients of the polynomial of degree 9, and we want it to match 10 points, well, that can be solved exactly. We can have an equation or 10 equations with 10 variables. We can solve these perfectly. We can actually even get to the zero training error, which seemed fine, but it actually is not that great, because on the test set, the errors don't really have the same progression. Well, at the beginning they do, they decrease, so where they copy the behavior of the training error, but at this moment where you're able to actually decrease the training error to zero, this test error increased rapidly. And this is like the difference between the optimization. And the optimization is trying to get as low on the training data as possible. And what we want to do in machine learning, where we want to behave well on the unseen examples. So ideally, in machine learning, we want to find, I don't know, maybe this point or this point, the minimum on the unseen data, right? On the test data in this situation. And there are two bad regimes. In the first regime, here, our test error is large because also our training error is large. We were not able to even fit the training data correctly. So this regime, it's called underfitting. Right? Because even on the training data, our error is too big, which makes the testing error also large. However, there is also a second possibility where the training error will be very small, actually zero for in our example, but the test error, the error on the unseen examples, is once again too low, too large. It's even much larger than it was with a very very simple models. And this regime is usually called overfitting. So we concentrated too much on the training examples. That's actually what the cause of the problem is. We tried to perfectly match the training data, and we were able to do so using this red curve. The problem is that we don't really care what happens near the training data, right? What happens in between them. And this red curve is really wild. So in some places, the differences between what we hope the model would predict and what it really predicts is really enormous. It's really very huge. Yep. And until the model did have the possibility to do it, like if it wasn't able to perfectly fit the training data, then the solutions were kind of fine. But whenever the model was able to actually like remember everything, like fit everything from the training data, in a sense, you can say that now it remembers all the training data, then its behavior outside of the train set is kind of catastrophic. And finding this sweet spot of the place where the generalization error is the best is something what we will be doing a lot. And one way how we can control whether the model overfits or underfits is by controlling its capacity. That's nearly what we did. So what a capacity is? Capacity is some abstract thing, abstract value, which tells us how much can the model actually remember, right? How rich functions it can model. Here, we were increasing the model capacity because we increased the number of features. We allowed the model to generate polynomials with higher and higher degrees. And we also increased the number of weights which the model can use for training. So this kind of capacity is called a representational capacity. It means we gave the model larger and larger strength or expressibility by allowing it to model more and more functions. It could model wider, like more advanced polynomials with higher and higher degrees. So it could represent more. That's why it's a representational capacity. Sometimes we'll also talk about the effective capacity. Sometimes we can influence what the model can learn by changing the training algorithm instead of really fiddling physically with the capacity itself. You will see an example in three or four slides. But anyway, generally, the training and generalization errors tend to look like this. Imagine that there is some kind of capacity on this x-axis. And the training error, that is the blue one, usually starts very high, which means we really didn't train at all. And then it tends to get smaller and smaller. However, the generalization error, the error on the tested, on the unseen data, firstly decreases as well as the training error. But at some point, the improvements are not that large, and it even usually starts going up. And that's here on the right side, it's the overfitting regime, where the training algorithm is too much concentrating on the training data themselves and doesn't leave, sorry, any space, any possibility for the for other additional values. Like it really don't care, doesn't care about any other value. So if it concentrates all the model capacity on the training data themselves, which might mean we are doing like horrendous error for values which are not in the training set. This curve, it's usually called a U-shaped curve, right, for of the generalization error. And our goal will be to like find this sweet spot, this optimal capacity where the development or generalization error is the lowest. So how could we control the capacity of the model besides just really changing the architecture? Before I'll tell you that, please know that this overfitting is usually a problem of having too little data. If we have little data and we try to model them better and better to really estimate their values more closer to whatever goal values we got, then we just ignore what's happening between these points, right? During the training on this left side, we just ignore these errors, right? Just try to fix the values in the training set and that's all. And the more we try, it can happen that the wilder the function will be and the more errors there will be created in the data which are not in the training set. However, if we had much more data, then this problem could be avoided because there would be no big gaps in the training data. So the possibility of the model doing something wild between the training data would be diminished considerably because it wouldn't have really so free possibility or so many chances to actually do something weird, something not similar to the data which we want to predict. However, increasing the training data is usually not simple. You cannot really just say, oh, I want to have more data, and then you magically end up with more data. It can easily happen that each of these actually costs hundreds or thousands of dollars, or maybe it costs like 5 hours of your work, and you probably don't want to spend the next 3 months just generating the examples. So it would be nice to have some other way how to battle overfitting. And generally, any technique which is designed to reduce the generalization error, it's called regularization. So this is a very broad definition saying, okay, whatever improves my behavior on unseen data, well, I'm calling this regularization. And finally, this regularization usually means you actually increase your training error. So that's fine. If you decrease the generalization error, it's fine if the training error goes up. So maybe if you perform some kind of regularization, maybe this green curve, I don't know, look like this. For the price of like increasing your training error, like this, for example. But you don't mind that you have increased the training error. The important thing which happened is that you were able to decrease the generalization error. So any procedure like that is called regularization. In case of our linear regression, straightforward, well-used, frequently used technique is the so-called L2 regularization. So the L2 regularization What it does is that it says, I don't like models which have large weights. The idea is that, well, firstly, right now it seems that the L2 regularization just I don't know, fell from heaven, right? It's a weird name, weird rule. So generally, I have to say that I don't like if things fall from heaven, just out of blue, like, oh, this is the good thing, you do this. And for the same reasons, I'm like wondering why is there two here? Why isn't it 2.5 or 3 or something? Right? So at this point, I agree that this just came, fell from heaven. And I will try in the whole course to avoid all these things. So there'll be a time where I will talk more about why it looks like this. But for the time being, let's just assume this is a good idea. And we will spend some time in the future to think about why this actually would be a good idea. So the idea is to somehow dislike the models which have large weights. How it would help us? Well, if we have function of order 9, and we say, well, we don't really like large weights, then the resulting function would not be allowed to be like so erratic as this one found by the optimization algorithm. This I say without proof, it's just an idea that if the values are not as large, then the change in behavior in the function would not be also able to be as large as if the weights were unbounded. So the smaller the values, the smoother the behavior. That's one of the ways how you can look at it. You say that you prefer models which behaves more smooth. They are not really up and down, but really like nice. And somebody is asking what the large is, and what I mean like looking at the second power of the weight. So when I say large, I really prefer W1 to be at 1, definitely more than it to be 2. Right, and what I explicitly measure is the second the square of the weights. So that's one thing how we can look at it. That by keeping the weight small, we will get a nicer and smoother function. The other way how we can look at it is that if you have some condition like this to say I don't like models with large weights, then the model won't be able to perfectly fit the training data, right? When you add a condition like that, it actually won't be able to find this weird function for fitting these 10 points. Instead, it will just go slightly differently around them. And the impossibility to go explicitly through the values will also make the model smoother. This is all hand waving, definitely, I agree, but that's the best what I will give you right now. So technically, how we are going to do it? Well, we tried to minimize the mean square error before, or sum of squares probably. We still want to minimize this, but we will also add a second part to our error function. We will say, okay, we do not only want to minimize the training error, but we also want to include this so-called regularization loss, this new part of the error function, which says, okay, I don't like large weights. Right? The larger the weights are, the larger the value of the training error, and we want to keep it small. These two things, they actually go against each other, right? If you just ignore the regularization loss, then you will be in the same overfitting regime as before, which we have seen can be very hurtful to our performance, right? On the other hand, if we say, okay, we will give this regularization, we will believe it like very strongly in it, like let's make this lambda constant 100, right? The errors Like the weights of the models are much more important for us than some training error. We don't care about the training error. We just want this regularization to hold. This our new preference over the models. And if you do it, then well, the model mostly learns to keep you satisfied by keeping the weights very minimal. And maybe it will come up with this fit, right? It's not a straight line, it goes slightly down, but it cannot really make large changes because this part of the error function disallow it from actually like learning much. And ideally, of course, we would like to balance these things out somehow. So ideally, we would like to choose the models with small weights, but not as much as to influence our training. Right? So there is a graph here on the right side, which shows you how the training error and the test error will look like when we change the magnitude of this lambda. There is a logarithm of lambda on this axis, and this is the performance of the model in this situation where we try to fit this polynom of degree 9 to the 10 training instances. So it looks like this. When the lambda is too large, we cannot even fit the training data. Right? So even the training error is large. If it would go more and more, it would be like even worse probably. So that's the situation where this part is too strong. Like we only want to get models with very small weights. Well, we can satisfy it by generating models with zero weights and we are done. Right? So we are underfitting there. But then when this parameter gets smaller and smaller, we try to learn more and more from the training data, which allows us to decrease the training error. And that is also like observable on the testing error, which is also improving. However, at some point, the training error will continue to go down and eventually reaching zero. But the testing error does not follow with this trend. Instead, it starts rising. Right? At this point, the model started overfitting by concentrating too much on the training data and just ignoring all the points which are outside of the train set. So here, ideally, you can see that we would prefer the value, I don't know, probably somewhere here. And that would be the model which would behave the best on the unseen examples. So this lambda, this parameter, actually controls the effective capacity of the model, right? If it is too large, then the capacity is very small because we can remember very little, but when it's increasing, I said it the other way around. So if it's large, then the capacity of the model is small. And if it is decreasing, the effective capacity of our model is larger and larger. And we are like allowed to remember more and more from the training data. And at some point, it starts to become hurtful. So ideally, we would be able to find this like specific value where it works the best. Technically, when we add this length of the weights to the loss function, we could repeat the calculations from the first lecture. I am not going to do it in detail, but generally what we did last time is we computed the derivative, right? So computing the derivative of this value, this square norm square of the distance or the length of the vector is just the scalar product of the vector with itself. So computing the derivative, I'm really using the vector notation here. So there is a vector here and there is even a vector here. So I'm not going to use this formula, it's just an idea. So when you do it, then the derivative looks like lambda times the weights. And the reason is this is something like very, very naively W squared. So computing the derivative will be 2 times W. This 2 will cancel out with this 2, right? And we will get lambda times W. If you would like to do it formally, we would do this for like one of these weights, right? And we look at this. So we can say, okay, so when we compute the gradient with respect to the full vector, we just get the vector on the outside. And in any case, this is the lambda w which we can find here. So you can redo the calculations in detail if you want, but what you arrive at is that the solution is very similar as before. There is just one additional element here, which is this lambda times I, lambda times identity matrix inside this this expression, right? So we can come up with algorithm for regularized linear regression, where we also get this constant lambda on the input, which changes the matrix which you want to invert. Now, how actually we will arrive at the correct version of lambda? The algorithm itself, this matching on the train set, it doesn't optimize it, it doesn't fit it. Nothing is happening. Like the algorithm is ignoring that the linear regression only trains the weights. So the weights, they are called the parameters. The parameters are all variables which are being optimized by the training. However, some of the parameters are not adapted by the learning algorithm itself. And these parameters we will call hyperparameters. And one of such a hyperparameter is this regularization lambda, or this capacity of the model M, which we talked about before. That's also a hyperparameter. And these hyperparameters, they are not adapted by the learning algorithm. And there are two reasons for that. One is that maybe it's not even viable, not even possible. For the capacity M, for the representational capacity, we cannot compute the derivative with respect to the discrete value. So we won't be even able to do it. And for this regularization parameter, we actually would be able to do it. We could compute the derivative of this also with respect to lambda. The problem is that if you want to minimize this regularization factor on the training data, well, the optimization would say, oh, I want this point here, right? Here we have zero training error. That's the best. So if you optimize lambda on the training data, it actually says, I am choosing zero, because that makes the training error go low as possible. But we know that that's not what we want, right? And the problem why this optimization doesn't work is that we don't want to get zero training error. That's optimization. But we, in machine learning, we want to make the testing error as small as possible. And for that, choosing lambda zero is actually not the best solution. But that the training algorithm cannot do it. The training algorithm only decreases the error on the train set. So how to actually set these hyperparameters, like how to find them so that our generalization error, our possibility to process unseen data, will be as high as possible? Well, one of the standard solutions to this problem is to actually divide the data further and end up with three parts of the data. One will be the train set. That's what we already have. And we will just use the linear regression fitting on the training data. Then we'll have the test set, which we use for evaluation. And now we'll have a new set. We'll call this set a validation set or development set. And we will use it to set the hyperparameters. When we train the model on the train set and then evaluate it on the development set, we get an idea how the model will generalize, like how well it will process unseen examples. So that's in the training, in the fitting, we are trying to minimize this blue curve. But on the development set, we can actually see how well it does on unseen examples. We can use this evaluation to choose the correct version of the hyperparameters. We will just really set it, like right now we'll do it very trivially. We can try 20 different values of the hyperparameter and measure what the best value is on the development set, and then say, ha ha ha, I like this one, and be done with it. Now that one would be inclined to say, okay, so let's use these both sets for the same thing, right? Why do we have two different sets? But it's actually important to have two of them, because the idea of the test set is to see the behavior on completely unseen examples. But in this development set, we actually influence the model by looking at the performance. Like, we try to minimize the performance on the development set. So in a sense, our machine algorithm is also learning from the development set, but not in the obvious way by setting the parameters, but by setting the hyperparameters, which algorithm it is, whether it uses regularization, what strong factor will the regularization have, how many features will be using, and these choices, they still influence the behavior. So when we want to evaluate the model, we cannot use the development set itself. We need some fresh, new, independent set of the data which we haven't seen yet. So in the end, we actually learn from both of these sets, right? But the training set is used for parameters and the validation slash development is used for hyperparameters. Up until now, we have seen two of these hyperparameters. One was the model capacity and one was the lambda. And they actually behaved quite similarly because they both influence the capacity of the model. And if we use the developments, then we can say, okay, so let's, I don't know, choose this one and choose, I don't know, this one to be our best solutions on the development sets. And this test would actually be just a development test. And then with this one chosen configuration, we could also run the evaluation on the test set and be happy. So are there any questions? Nope, it doesn't seem so. So this is like basic settings. We want to train the algorithm. We usually use the training set for it, but we also probably have some hyperparameters, and we actually do not want to minimize the training error. We use it to learn something, but in the end, it's not what we want. So we have the development set, which allow us to see how well are we going to do on some unseen examples, and maybe use it to set some hyperparameters. Now let's take a step back and let's dig a bit more into the solution of the linear regression in case where things wouldn't go as smoothly as I promised you on the previous lecture. So when solving and finding the optimum weights, we came up with this equation, which is okay, the optimum weights have to fulfill this. So this matrix, whatever it is on the left side, times the weights need to be equal to this vector. Now, if this matrix is regular, then it is an inverse. So this system of equations will have a unique solution, and we can explicitly compute it, and we are done, and that's what we did up until now. However, this matrix may not be regular, and in that case, we will need to do something else. So if you recall from your linear algebra courses, the rank of a matrix is the same as the rank of this Gram matrix, which is original matrix transpose times the matrix. If you don't know it, then just take my word for it. But what this means, well, this matrix XD times X has signs D times D. Right, we have got X matrix. The X matrix has got n rows and d columns. And if you multiply it by X transposed, we get a result which will be d times d. So if this should be regular, it means that d is also the rank of the original matrix. So in the original matrix, we have d columns and n rows, and the individual rows are the individual training examples. So if this matrix has d independent columns, which means if all the features, if there are like features as at, sorry, if there are at most as many features as the training data, and if they are all regular, so if they are all independent, then we know that this x times x, x transpose times x, is actually regular, and there is a unique solution. Kind of makes sense. If you have features which are independent, so they can be combined from each other, and there are limited by the number of examples, and there is a unique solution which tells you which feature will explain which value. However, in many situations, it can happen that this is not the case. Either you have some features which are, well, in all cases, you have the features which are dependent on each other, but sometimes it makes sense to actually have more features than the input examples. Imagine that we have a word on the input, like, I don't know, dog. We would like to know something about it. What the features could be, well, the features could be, I don't know, the suffixes, so G or OG or even DOG, or we could also have the prefixes D, DO, right? We could have some other features, like whether it's all in lowercase, uppercase, or there are some numbers, a lot of various features. All of these could be interesting, but there can easily be much more features than the training examples themselves. Either each word has several prefixes, several suffixes, so it may really happen. And in these situations, we might also want to still be able to solve the linear regression problem. And in these situations, this equation actually, it still has a solution. It is still solvable, but this time it's not unique, the solution, right? There are multiple possibilities how these different prefixes and suffixes could be responsible for the outcome. And there is not just one, as in the previous case, but there are multiple. So what we can do, well, we actually can try to find the smallest weights which will fulfill the equations. Well, why smallest is just because it can be, you will see it also for yourself, that there is like a unique solution. So from the set of all possible solutions, we still have taken we have chosen one unique solution. And the good thing about this solution, we want to minimize this, is that if you can imagine that there are like multiple features responsible for some outcome, then if you say that you want the smallest weight solution, then if the model can choose how to distribute, weights or distribute strengths among these two features, then if these different weights might be like the smallest as possible, then the best thing which you can do is we can divide them uniformly. Okay, so this looks really terrible. So imagine that you have got two features, and let's say that f1 plus f2 is, or maybe let's say that these f2, I'm sorry, I don't have it really. Prepared. So let's have these two features, F1, F2, right? And let's say that, F2 is just F1 times 2, right? It's twice as many. Now we need to explain some value. So we either can choose just F1 to explain the value and not use F2 at all, or we might say, okay, we will use F2, we'll use that to explain the value and we'll just ignore F1. But it probably makes sense to somehow say, okay, so I'm going to consider both of these features to explain the solution. And that's exactly what this smallest weight solution does, because it tries to assign weights to the individual features explaining this value. And what it will try to do, well, when two features are explaining the value like in the same way or very similarly, then it will give them like uniform weights. Like it will tell, okay, F1, F2, you both are doing the same thing, so you can just contribute in the same way to the result. And that's what this specific solution will do, and that will allow like to distribute the responsibility to all the input features. So let's go through it. You might have seen or realized this weird symbol on the slide. There will actually be parts of the lectures where I'll be showing you some theory or some math or some parts, which I won't require you to actually learn for the exams, right? So this is like a danger sum sign, which means, okay, these slides are going to be slightly more mathematically advanced, but you are not required to learn them for the exam. So they might make you understand more, or you might get some insights from them. On the other hand, they might require some more mathematical knowledge. So this time I'm going to show you how you can actually solve this system of equations and find the solution with the smallest norm. For that, the singular value decomposition is hugely useful. When you have a matrix, you can always decompose it using this SVD into three matrices, U, sigma, and V, where the U and V are orthogonal matrices. And by orthogonal matrices, I mean that when you multiply transpose of the U times U, you get just the identity, and the same for V. So two orthogonal matrices and one diagonal matrix. So diagonal matrix has zero everywhere on all but diagonal. When you look at these at linear mappings, then this says, okay, when you have a mapping, you can always represent it as a rotation, like this orthogonal matrix, that's just a rotation. It cannot shrink or enlarge dimensions, it can only rotate. So rotation, then just shrinking and enlarging in the axis, and then rotation back. There are ways how you can compute it, and I actually assume that you have seen this and you know how it works. If not, then don't hesitate to learn it by yourself, read it on Wiki, but it won't be required for the exam. Now, because these U's and V's are orthogonal, they are regular. So if the X matrix doesn't have a full rank, then it must be the diagonal matrix which is responsible for it. So assume that we have this diagonal matrix. It has R elements, R non-zero elements, I'm sorry. So if it has a rank R, it will have R non-zero values. And so let's assume that it's the first ones, right? And then there are really a lot of zeros around it. This will actually help us and allow us to write this matrix X without these zero parts, right? So we will just throw this away, and we will keep only this upper left corner of this diagonal matrix. It has got these R subscripts so that we know it's just the first R values. Now, when we have this this product where we multiply this by U and by V transposed, so if we just drop these values, we can ignore these lines here, right? The ones corresponding to the zero columns you want to throw, we can ignore. And similarly, because we are dropping these values, then some of the columns of U can be dropped as well. So if we take just the first R columns of U and first R rows of V transposed, then we can write the matrix using these like sub matrices, and we will get the same results because even if we dropped these parts, they would just give us zero, so they would have no influence on the result. And this is like the key thing. We had a mapping which had lower dimensionality than it could, like it was a singular one. And this SVD decomposition allowed us to identify which directions actually these are. Right, so we have kept only these R important directions where the mapping actually does something, and we have just dropped the dimensions where the mapping just gives us zero. And the good thing is that in this new decomposition, all these three matrices have full rank. So we will use this decomposition and we will plug it in the equation which we want to solve. Now, because these U's and V's were orthogonal, they multiplied together, they gave identity matrix. So even these subparts of them still have this property. So these will cancel out. If we multiply it by VTR and VTR, then this will also cancel out. So we'll arrive at this form. We have got two diagonal matrices, the same ones, right? The transpose of the real diagonal matrix is just the same thing. And it should be equal to this thing. And now the trick is that this matrix, which was not regular before, is now regular because we have kept only the values where there are non-zero numbers. And we end up with the solution, which tells us, okay, so this VTRW should be equal to this right-hand side. And now, in the original case, where the matrix was singular, this diagonal matrix is actually this full sigma matrix, right? It's the exact one. It's the one which we started, because this submatrix is just the full one. So the solution for the case of the regular input is just this thing. So we have got these two orthogonal matrices here, and one diagonal matrix where we have computed the inverse of the values on the diagonal. And we are nearly there. Now, if this interesting situation happened because of which we are actually talking about it, that this matrix has a lower rank, right? So this diagonal matrix had some zeros, and we are only looking at its non-zero upper left corner. So in this case, this equation has infinitely many solutions, right? Because it means we have this matrix, it has got a rank R, this W has rank D, which is larger than R. So we have got a linear set of linear equations with a singular matrix. So such a set of equations have infinitely many solutions. And we want to find the one which has the smallest norm, the smallest one. And in order to find it, we can use the fact that this V is just an orthogonal matrix. So it's just a rotation. It doesn't change lengths. So solution with the smallest norm W is also the one with the smallest norm of WTW. And now we are nearly there. When you look at this, we know that the first R elements are fixed by this equation, right? In the place where the mapping, where the matrix behaves nicely, we have a unique solution. However, what to do outside these values, right? What to do after them? Well, we can actually choose any values in these last dimensions. But if you want to make this value smallest, well, why we can choose zeros, right? If we choose zeros in the other dimensions, well, then that would be a solution which has the smallest norm. So to write this down, what we do is, let's look at this part, right? This sigma, that's the diagonal matrix, which has some non-zero values here, and then it has zero values all over here. And now this result, well, that's what we seek for. So in this first R rows, this will have the value which we are deemed, or which we need to fulfill. And if we use this this sigma matrix, which has got zeros here, well, this will actually produce a zero on these dimensions after this R interesting ones. And that's exactly what we want. We wanted a solution where this VW would be zero, and this is exactly it. So even in the singular case, this is actually the optimum solution, right? So to sum up, or maybe to connect this to something else, you may heard something about pseudo inverses. So if you have a system of linear equations which doesn't have a regular matrix X, it doesn't have an exact solution. It has usually infinitely many solutions too. So to find it, we could use something which is called a pseudo inverse, which is like such an inverse of the matrix which will give us a solution which is the closest to the one possible. And by closest we mean with the smallest mean square error actually. And if you try to solve this, you'll go through very similar math which we just did, and you will find out that what we came up with is actually like the pseudo inverse for the matrix, which we can use to find the solution which has the smallest norm. And also another way how you can come up with this pseudo inverse is to say, okay, I've got a matrix Y. I would like to find an inverse for it. So what this inverse should fulfill, well, it should be equal to identity, right? But when it's not possible, then we could at least try to hope that this product will be as close to identity as possible. In that case, we can say, okay, so let's try such a matrix that will, I'm sorry, there is a mistake, I'm writing it down. We try to find such, it should be X here, right? To find such a matrix which will minimize this difference. So it will be as close to the identity as possible. And once again, if you solve this, you once again get the same formula. So we were able to come up with the solution even in the cases where there is not a unique one. And now there are two main messages from these danger sum slides. The first message is that it actually can be done. So if you are interested in knowing how exactly it works, well, we can solve the linear regression even without the regular matrix X, D, X. The second message, maybe even a bit more interesting one, is that this actually is messy. We come up with a very simple algorithm. We tried to find the optimum solution exactly, and it was difficult, right? We need to go through a lot of maths and do a lot of non-trivial like thoughts changes, or how to say it, like modifications to our equations to solve such a simple problem as just a linear regression. So keeping this up, finding optimal solutions for other much more complex models is not going to be feasible, right? It was difficult now, and it would be much more difficult in the future. So it would actually be nice if we could find some different possibility, to find some different approach which would allow us to train our model on the training data. So any questions? Nobody wants to ask anything. Nope. Doesn't seem so. Okay, so now we successfully went through the danger sum thing. And now let's leave the explicit solution to the linear regression behind us. Before I will talk about our alternative solution by a different way, how we can find the minimum of the error function, I will need to go through some basic notations. Generally, I wanted to start the course by really showing you some real examples at the beginning. So I will be intermixing some definition throughout these first three lectures or so with the other machine learning stuff. So now is the time for some number of definitions. And what I want to talk about is random variables. So random variable is result of some random process. Let's say that I've got a dice die, and I will roll it, and I will get a number from 1 to 6. Right? Or I've got a coin, I'm going to flip it, and I get heads or tails. You cannot really like say that this process always ends up in the die showing two, because it's stochastic, it's somehow random. So that's what the random variables are for, because they can capture this phenomenon of actually changing depending on the outcome of the process. These random variables, they can be discrete or continuous. In discrete case, if you have got these coin flips, that it's either head or tails, right? So there are two, there are values actually. Or it can be continuous if, if like everybody sitting here and listening to the lecture would, I don't know, step on a weight and they would say how much kilograms they weigh, that would be a random variable, but a continuous one, because this time there are, like, you can like you can compute your weight to an infinite precision if you want, or to as large precision as you want. So this random variable is connected with the values which it can have, but it's also important to know which of these values are actually probable. And to describe this, the chance of this process ending up with one of these outcomes, we have the notion of the probability distribution. So this distribution tells us how likely are the individual values this random variable can take. And what we do is we say, okay, this X random variable, if it's distributed by the probability distribution, we use this symbol here, and that says, okay, so the chance, the probability that this random variable has this specific value is, I don't know, 0.3 or something. So for the discrete case, the probability distribution is actually straightforward, and it's just a vector of probabilities. For each of the outcomes, for each of the possibilities, for the finitely many possibilities, can have just the probability. If it is distribution, then all these probabilities must be non-negative, because the probability of minus 0.5 doesn't make any sense, and they also need to sum to one. So when we go over all the possible values of this random variable, we can get one. So this is all and super easy. In the continuous case, it's a bit more tricky. Usually, probability distribution in the continuous case is described by function px. It's called a probability density function. But this probability density function doesn't have the same interpretation as in the discrete case. In the discrete case, it actually tells us what the probability is that the outcome will be of this value. But if you, I don't know, think about heights of people, then if you look at one specific height, probably, let's say, I don't know, 173.2149 centimeters. Then the probability density function says, okay, there is non-trivial density, but it doesn't mean this is really the probability of someone having this explicit height. Right, if I would be measuring people going to the lecture, which unfortunately now they cannot, there will be like chance of a literally zero of somebody coming and having the specific weight. So how this density function is interpreted? Well, what you can do is you can look at range, right? So the probability of this outcome of this random process to be in this range from A to B, well, that can be computed by computing the area under this probability density function. And this means if the range is very small, it gets smaller and smaller, and if this range will be size zero from A to A, it will just say zero. So there's no chance to fit this exact value. But once you make the range larger, you will start getting better values. And then the only thing which you need is to say, okay, I want the area under the sum to be one. But note that this means that the density function can actually have values which are larger than one, right? That couldn't happen in the discrete case. But in the continuous case, you can easily have a function which PDF, which is has values much larger than one, because the area is always one, then everything is fine. it's still reasonably defined, even if the density is larger than one.
Yep.
Now, an important definition connected to random variables is expectation. I actually assume you have already heard about it, but I'm repeating it here to remind you. An expectation of a random variable is, in a sense, like an average or expected outcome of the random process. And what we can compute the expectation of some given formula, assuming that we have got a random variable which samples values or which obtains values from this probability distribution. And what we do, well, we go over all the values in the discrete case. We compute the value of this formula at hand, and we weight it by the probability of this of the outcome of the random value to actually take this value. If this probability distribution is a uniform one, for example, let's say that I've got the die thing, and I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and all these possibilities are just uniform, I've got 1/6 and 1/6, 1/6 for all of these, then this expectation is actually just the average, right? This is just the average value, but if the distribution is different, then the average and the expectation might be different. In the continuous case, it's the same thing. We just replace the sum by the integral and the distribution by the probability density function. There are a lot of, this is like the richest notation which you can use, but if the random variable is known from context, you can just drop it and just write the distribution. If also the distribution is obvious, we can just drop it as well. So you can even see things like expectation of X, but that still means for random variable X, according to some probability distribution. This expectation has an important property that it's linear. By that, I mean that constants independent on X can be taken out of the expectation. And also, when you have two functions added inside the expectation, you can just add the expectation of the individual functions. This is all super easy to see, because when you look at the definition, then when you compute this sum or this integral, you can always the integral of sums is the sums of integral, and the sum of an addition is addition of the sums. And then whenever the constant doesn't belong on X, we can take it before the sum, right? So this is super simple, but we will be using this super often. So that's one thing. We can get the expectation, the expected value of a random variable. Another thing connected to this is variance. Variance measures how much does this result of this random process differ from the mean. If you have a distribution like this, then if you know just the expectation, then the distribution either can usually take the values very close to the expectation, or the distribution might take values which are further apart, but still have the same expectation. And the variance actually measures this. So it measures like the average distance between an outcome and the expectation. The smaller the variance, the more concentrated the distribution is, and the larger the variance, the more widespread it is. Formally, when we measure the distance, we look at the distance between the X and the expectation. If these two E's expectations are looking bad, well, we can just say, okay, so let's imagine that this is a mean, right? So this E is not important there. This is just the expectation. And we look at what the average square of their distance is. And that's variance. When you look this definition, you can multiply the parentheses, so you'll get that this variance is actually like the x squared plus 2 times x times the expectation plus the expectation of x squared. And this can be rewritten to the expectation of the x squared plus the square of the expectation. And what does this mean? Well, this means that the variance is actually connected to this value, which is called a second moment. That's the expectation of the square of the value. And in fact, it's a centered second moment. So if the expectation of the data would be zero, right, then this would be zero and the variance would exactly be the second moment. So sometimes the variance is called a centered second moment, which means when we center the data, which means we add some constant to them so that the expectation is zero, then the expectation of the second moment is the variance. You will see later why this is important, and I promise it will be. So, random variables, expectations, and variance. Why we are talking so much about expectations? We will be estimating the values of expectations quite often. So, assume that we have got some expectation of a random variable, and we want to estimate its value. Then any process which can do it will be called an estimator. This estimator, which tries to come up with the idea what value this should have, that will be useful. One thing which we could estimate, for example, is to compute the mean of a random variable by sampling, right? So let's say that we want to compute this expectation, which was there already. And what we do, we, let's say, sample one x1, just one value according to this distribution, and then say, okay, so this is 1 point estimate of this expectation. Right. Or maybe we could sample several of them, x2, x3, then compute the mean, and then say, okay, this is also an estimate of this value. Now, when we talked about the estimates, then some of the estimates are probably good ones. These will probably do the right thing, right? If we would say, okay, so our estimator just always returns one, then that's probably a bad estimate, right? Even if it's possible that this value will be one, then one of these x's will be one. So even if it's possible for this estimator to return one, it will do it with very small probability, and just return one all the time is probably not a good time. So to distinguish between good estimators and not so quality estimators, we will use this bias definition. The bias of the estimate evaluates what the difference between the expected value of the estimate and the true estimated value is. So this is like a systematic error which our estimator does. If it doesn't do any systematic error, on average, and that's what the expectation here is for. So if it doesn't do any error, then it's probably a good one, right? There is no problem in it. However, if it does, then it's not such a high quality estimator. And we call it an estimator unbiased if this bias is zero, right? So an unbiased estimate is a good one because on average it has the correct value. Otherwise, we call it biased, and the biased estimators might not be great ones. Now, assume that we have got some random distribution, and we have sampled n points from it. So we have got x1 to xn taken from some probability distribution. It's quite easy to see that if you say, okay, I will estimate expectation or the mean, estimate expectation by the mean. So I would say, okay, so let's just compute the average and I say, okay, so this is our estimate of the expectation. Then this expectation is unbiased, right? Because on average, this value should actually be the expectation. And that's a good thing. So that's a good way how to estimate the expectation. On the other hand, I'm sorry, there's an error. This should be squared here up. Imagine that you also want to estimate variance. Natural way how to do it would be to use the definition of variance and then just, okay, so compute the sum of the squares of the distances of the sampled points and the estimated expectation and compute an average on this. But this actually is not an unbiased estimate because it can be shown that on average, the value is slightly smaller than the real variance. And it's smaller by the factor of 1 minus 1 over n. I hope you have actually seen this already, so you know this for a fact, or at least maybe shown shown a proof or something. I don't know if you also like intuitively know what's wrong with this estimate. So let me show you my intuition around that. Imagine that we only have 2 points, which will be x1 and x2. When we estimate the mean, we choose the ideal value, right? So we choose just the average of these 2 points. And then when we estimate variance, when we estimate variance, we just take the distances of the points to this ideal mean. Now imagine that we would use a different mean. I don't know, this one or this one. So in the case of the left one, when we would then compute the variance, it would be these two distances. And because we take the square of the distances, it can be shown that this estimate would actually be larger than the orange one. Right? Actually, for any other value than for the real mean of the values, if we would use the sample variance, it would be larger than the orange one. So in a sense, this estimate is the smallest possible. That's the one which you would get if the mean was actually the one which is sampled. That's really the minimum. For any other value of me, the variance is actually larger. And that's why this is actually an erroneous thing. Like there is some chance that the mean is not the one which we have estimated from the data, but it's maybe slightly different, right? And all these changes, they would actually make this variance estimate larger. And that's what we need to do. We need somehow to think about the possibility that actually our expectation estimate is off. And if we do it correctly, you can see that it's actually off by this specific factor, right? So what you can do, you can say, okay, so this should actually be 1 over n minus 2. For the case of the 2 points, we actually take twice as large value as the smallest possible one. However, such an estimate is still a good one in a sense that this constant, this systematic error, it actually goes to zero. Right, so the bias, which we have defined, like the difference between the averaged return or averaged result of our estimator and the real value, then it converges to zero. So in a sense, it's still a good estimator. Even if there is some error, it hopefully at least goes to zero. And why am I talking about these estimators, which do have some kind of a bias? Well, it's not only about an estimator being unbiased. Unbiased gives us the really the best value, but it might be very noisy. It might happen that the biased estimate the unbiased estimate might have a large variance. So let's say that I want to estimate this value. What I will do is, well, okay, so I will just draw, I don't know, one sample, this one. So this actually has a very large variance because this one sample is very far from the expectation. On the other hand, if we had a biased estimator, but with smaller variance, maybe it would be more useful. Even if it does some systematic error, it tends to sample the values much closer to the real value. So when you look at just one sample, the variance is smaller. So what we will need is we will need to somehow balance both views. So we will prefer, of course, unbiased estimates, but even the biased ones can be fine if they at least converge to the right value, and especially if they have smaller variance. And also these estimators, which at least converge to zero, then these are called, it just slipped out of my mind, consistent estimators. This was a lot remarks about estimating value. So what actually is this useful for, right? Why am I spending so much time talking about it? Now we get to the point. And let's get back to our original problem, right? We want to minimize some function. We have an error function. We want to minimize it. But instead of computing an explicit solution, which we did for the linear regression before, we will use an iterative solution, like a process, which will also hope or try to find the minimum. And the process will be called a gradient descent. The idea is the following. Let's say that we have a function. We want to find a minimum. So what we will do is we will just go downhill, right? When we are somewhere in the nature, what we can do is we can just, I don't know, look around and then find the direction where there is like a steepest downhill, where the direction where we can descend the most if we'll go through that. That's probably this direction. And then we will do fixed side step, I don't know, one like a human step in this direction. And we have moved a bit. And we can repeat. So we can look around, find the direction which has the steepest descent, like it goes as low as possible. Then do one human side step and repeat. So let's look around, find the direction, do a human side step. And so on and so on. And hopefully this process will actually converge or find the minimum of the function. So to do this technically, we use, it's called a gradient, so we'll use a gradient. Like the gradients are the partial derivatives of the loss function with respect to all the weights. So if you have a partial derivative of this loss function with respect to one of the weights, then what does this mean? Well, one way how to interpret this is to say, okay, so if we increase W1 by a very small value, then this error function, it will increase by this value times this partial derivative, right? If we moved a bit in the W1, then the loss function will increase or decrease by this value, by this partial derivative. So one way how you can interpret these partial derivatives is that there are like tensions of the function. So in this 1D case, the direction is either left or right. So either the derivation is positive or negative. And even like the larger the value is, the more the function changes at that point. In multiple dimensions, it's the work the same. This partial derivative, like the gradient, like all the partial derivatives, they point to the place in space where the function would increase the most if you have changed the weights. we actually don't want to increase the value as large. So what we do is like we can look in the direction of the gradient and then do a backward step, right? Because if it's most uphill in that direction, then it's most downhill in the opposite one. So that's what this formula does, right? This gradient, just the direction of the steepest ascent. Well, with the minus, it's actually the formula of the steepest descent. And then we need also the length of the step, right? So the human size steps, so maybe this alpha could be just, I don't know, 0.1. That's normal human size steps in, tens of meters or something like that. Technically, this length of the step is called the learning rate. And it exactly tells you like how far do you want to go in the direction of the gradient. In our case, when training a machine learning model, the important thing is that this mean square error, for example, which we talked about, we defined it as the sum, but it can also be computed as an expectation. You can say, okay, the mean square error is the expectation when we take the features and the target values from the data. And then we compute it's called loss in this slide, right? But in our case, in the mean square error, we will take a look at what the model predicts, compute the distance to the real output, and compute the square. Generally, we can call this a loss function, but in our case, for example, for the mean square error, we mean this one specific one. But the important thing that it can actually be an expectation, right? So assume that this error function we want to minimize is actually an expectation. So to compute it, we might take different strategies. One strategy is to compute this expectation explicitly, right? That's what we did up until now. We really like went through all the examples. We had all the matrix with the values and so on. So that's what we can do. We can compute this exactly. And such an algorithm is called a gradient descent, sometimes a regular gradient descent if you want to make it explicit. The problem, of course, is that for each step, you need to go through all the training data. So if you've got thousands, hundreds, millions, even more examples, then going through all of them before one small update, that's really inefficient. And now the estimators come into play. We could actually estimate this expectation by some estimator. One way how to sample an expectation is actually to take a single point estimate, right? We can sample one point, compute the value, and this is actually an unbiased estimate, because on average, it has got this average value, but it's very noisy, right? The variance of such an estimator is very large because we can really take one value, that one specific value can be much different than the expectation. So unbiased, but very noisy estimate. But still, it's a useful algorithm, and it's called stochastic or online gradient descent. We have got a noise estimate, and we do the update in the noise estimate, like we do one step with this noise estimate, and then we take another point and like another random point, have another estimate, and go on, so on and so on and so on. Up until now, we have like two extremes if you consider it. Either use all the data or use one piece or instance of the data. And so one has zero noise, but is very slow to compute, and the other is unbiased, but is very noisy and very fast to compute. So what we can do is we can go somewhere in between, actually. And this in-between solution is called a mini-batch SGD. Often when you say SGD, you explicitly mean this mini-batch without telling. So what you do, you actually sample some number of training data, not just one, not all of them. I don't know, imagine 20. Right, and then you compute these 20 values and compute an average of them. It can be shown that this is once again an unbiased estimate, but this time with much smaller variance. So it's good. we were able to make our estimate much more accurate for the price of doing more computation, but maybe, I don't know, only 10 times as many or 20 times as many in the stochastic case, which can be much better than millions of the training examples. There is a question, why do we choose these examples randomly? Both of these implementations can be found. So either you really choose the data randomly, or instead of choosing them really randomly, you make sure that you process every example before you start processing any other twice. So in that case, what you can do is you can first take all your data, shuffle them, so compute a random permutation, and then go through this permutation in order. So you process each data once before you start processing some other data. This is actually how we are also going to implement SGD, but generally for the SGD to work, this estimate, this expectation should really be unbiased. When you say that you, for example, I don't know, go through the data in the same order all the time, then it won't be really a good estimate. And it could happen that it would actually not converge to the right result. So you need to add randomness to the SGD. But of course, instead of really sampling a random batch, you might like first sample each example randomly and then only sample the examples for the second time. So in the end, we have a real gradient, which we don't want to compute. Instead, we have an estimate, a noisy one. And we update the weights using the gradient descent. Because of this noisiness of the estimate, does this actually converge? Right? Does this gradient descent goes to the minimum? And the answer is yes. It has actually been proven for nearly 70 years. And if this loss function L is convex, I will talk about it in a minute, then this SGD converges to optimum almost surely if the sequence of the learning rates fulfills some of the conditions. So why a convex function? The algorithm can actually only find a local optimum, right? It just goes downhill. So if there are two minimas, it wouldn't be able to switch between them or so. So people actually considered the functions which were like convex, which means they're like a bowl, right? They have only one minimum. So if you find a local minimum, this local minimum is also a global minimum. So if the function is really convex, it's like obvious where the minimum is, then we can find it. These conditions for the learning, what do they say? Well, first, these learning rates, they have to go to zero. Well, it makes sense because if they didn't go to zero, well, you may jump over the minimum indefinitely. So they need to go to zero. On the other hand, you cannot go to zero too fast. If you go to zero too fast, then at this point, your steps are already very slow and you will never get to the real optimum, right? So you need to be able to travel an unlimited amount. So the sum of the learning rates needs to be unbounded. However, this might make the noisiness in this estimator too large. So we also need to know that the learning rates go down fast enough so that they can battle the variance present in our estimate of the real gradient. And technically this works out by limiting the second moment of the learning rate sequence. One possibility which fulfills all these conditions is a sequence of 1/n. Right? It goes to zero, it sums to infinity, but the sum of 1/n² is actually limited by time some constant. By the way, if the function is not convex, then we cannot guarantee actually much. We can guarantee converging to a local optimum. So if it looks like this, we start at this point, we can still find this optimum, but that's all. We cannot actually find this nor this part. But note that if the function is really general, it's not convex, then finding a minimum, like a global minimum, is actually at least NP hard. Like it's really extremely difficult problem. So having a general algorithm which would be able to find minimums of any function, well, that's very unlikely. So a GD does find a local minimum. And for that, the convex functions are nice because the convex functions have a unique optimum and the local and the global one is the same. The well-known examples of convex function is, well, x squared. Hint, this is what we use in the mean square error, right? But also the exponential function e to x and minus logarithm of x are also nice convex functions. Well, their minimums are on the edges. But anyway, we will be using them as well as the loss functions. Yep. So let me show you the last slide. How can we actually use this on our linear regression problem? In our linear regression problem, let's assume that we are using this online or stochastic gradient descent, which means our loss, the mean square error, will be, which is an expectation of this prediction of the model minus the real value squared, will be estimated by computing this estimate j, which will be the gradient of one sample, right? So when we get one x, we will just say, okay, x1 scalar multiplied by the weight minus di squared and the gradient of that, right? So the gradient of that, I'm just going to write it, then you can verify it on your own. The gradient of that is 2 times x itw minus di, right? This is something squared, so it's 2 times the inside times the derivative of this inner function, and that's just xi. So using this, we will arrive at this algorithm. We will sample a point, and then we'll update the weight so that on this one specific point, we decrease our training error. So for example, here, I'm just going through the points in the sequential order, which I said is a bad idea, and I will get to that on the next. Or on the practicals maybe, but in the simplest case, if I went through the data sequentially, then I would update my weights after each example, trying to improve the model to work specifically only on this example, right? That's what the estimate of the overall gradient is, just how it will behave on this one specific example. And with some reasonable assumptions, this can actually converge to the optimum solution with. Well, so I agree there was some math behind it, but the good thing is that this would actually work with any loss function. Right? It wouldn't have to be mean squared error, whatever you come up with, and it's convex, you could have used it in here. Yep, so that's like a hint of what we will actually be using to solve our problems. Are there any questions? No questions? Everything is clear? Okay, I can see a question. Is there some reasonable heuristic for choosing the learning rate? The answer is not really. It's not easy. It's not easy to answer. Generally, you want to choose the highest learning rate, which makes the progress reasonably good. So you want it to be large enough so that the model actually trains effectively, but not too large so that it wouldn't converge, or that it wouldn't find the optimum. So I don't think that was the answer you were looking for, but it's generally the best thing there is. In practice, there are nowadays people use algorithms which somehow dynamically change the learning rate. So you still have to choose it, but just the initial one, and they are being adaptively changed so that you don't have to deal with it. But we won't see that or use that in this course. I do that only in the deep learning course. So for us, just trying to see if with some of the learning rate the model converges, then maybe you can try increasing it until it still works, but it's not really a great answer. Okay, it seems there are no other questions. Mm-hmm. Well, we need, because there is infinitely many solutions, we need to decide what we are going to find. We could go and characterize the whole subspace of the of all the weights. The idea is that when you look at the features, then if the solution is not unique, then it means you can explain the outcomes by differently weighting the features. Like if two features are very much the same, you can either say, okay, it's the first feature's fault, or it's the second feature's fault, or they are like on equal on it. And the intuition behind why we want the smallest W is that if this happens, we want the model to actually believe all the input features. So if both this F1 and this F2 can explain the outcome, we want the model to actually say, okay, both of these do explain the outcome like in the same way, with the same strength. And that's exactly what will happen if you say that you want the smallest W. Maybe it's not really visible, but if you imagine that you would like make this twice the size and this nothing, then the length of this W squared would be increased by 4 times. And so it would be 3 times as large as if you would really distribute this equally. So technically, we want to find a unique one so that we would know what we are looking for. And for that, the minimum norm is like a technical solution. But also, this is a nice interpretation. It will try to value, to weight the input features as uniformly as possible. Okay, so thank you very much for your attention. Please enjoy your week. We will see each other hopefully on the Wednesday practicals. If not, there will be assignments, recordings, everything present on the website. And see you around. Have a nice week.